Good afternoon, everyone. This is Donna Pomerantz, and I think that I would like to go ahead and start us off with a door prize.
$25 from Bayview, and
we have $25 from Bayview, and we have a goodie bag. And the goodie bag is from
Sacramento chapter.
From ACB Capital Chapter.
Steve Mendelson,
are you in here? Steve Mendelson is not in here.
Sometimes I have to throw a hat when he doesn't do these things.
All right, let's see. Can you call Donna Pomerantz?
Anthony Dowley.
Oh, he's not here either. See, the early bird catches the... Well, there aren't any worms in the goodie bag, so I won't say that.
This is Bonnie Trotted.
Okay, we're going. We're still going.
Okay. Louis Herrera.
Louis, are you in the room?
Not here.
Why? They need to be on time.
And Maria Casanova.
Hold on 1 second. I hear on the outside, who is saying...
Where?
Is she... Yeah, if they're working at tables for chapters or other organizations, that one doesn't. It's working for at registration or at the volunteer table.
Okay.
So,
keep drawing.
Please. Wait, who did you draw?
Maria Casanova,
where are you?
Right.
Oh, I passed her in the hall.
Yeah.
Don't pick that Margie, that's for sure.
Debbie Pert.
We're going.
You might have a break.
Make sure you don't get that Margie. We don't want to. Kate Del Ross. But she's not in the room.
Where is she? Rachel. That's you? Okay, she's here.
She is. All right. Yay. $25 and a goodie bag. Enjoy. And I am going to hand the general session over to today's presiding officer, second vice president, my partner in crime, who's helped me a lot in a number of ways, Roger Peterson.
It's those neck massagers that she really likes.
No, don't start those.
It's my pleasure to, I think it's my pleasure, to preside over this session for the first time as second vice president. And as my first activity, I wish to introduce for the invocation Deborah Reeves, who is Secretary Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'i, Sacramento, California, for the invocation. Ms. Reeves?
Thank you for inviting me here today, and I will be reading a prayer, one of the Baha'i prayers. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. O thou merciful God, O thou who art mighty and powerful, O thou most kind Father, these servants have gathered together, turning to thee, supplicating thy threshold, desiring thine endless bounties from thy great assurance. They have no purpose save thy good pleasure. They have no intention save service to the world of humanity. O God, make this assemblage radiant. Make the hearts merciful. Confer the bounties of the Holy Spirit. Endow them with a power from heaven. Bless them with heavenly minds. Increase their sincerity so that with all humility and contrition, they may turn to thy kingdom and be occupied with service to the world of humanity. May each one become a radiant candle. May each one become a brilliant star. May each one become beautiful in color and redolent of fragrance in the kingdom of God. O kind Father, confer thy blessings. Consider not our shortcomings. Shelter us under thy protection. Remember not our sins. Heal us with thy mercy. We are weak, thou art mighty. We are poor, thou art rich. We are sick, thou art the physician. We are needy, thou art most generous. O God, endow us with thy providence. Thou art the powerful, thou art the giver, thou art the beneficent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reeves. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce for the Pledge of Allegiance activities and the presentation of the colors, the Girl Scouts Heart of Central California Color Guard. You may proceed, ladies. I understand they will tell us when to rise.
Audience, please rise for the presentation of the colors. Color guard attention. Color guard advance. Ladies and gentlemen, the flag of our country. Please join me in saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Color guard dismissed. Audience, you may be seated.
You're going to tell us who you are, color guard?
Okay. My name's Alyssa, and I'm from Antelope.
My name's Megan, and I'm from El Dorado Hills.
My name's Linda. I'm from Antelope.
Great job, girl. Thank you very much. Okay. The next item, this is our history item, guys. I always love these things, the history of, you know, things that, about the local area. The presenter is a professional and degreed person in the area of public history and interpretation of history. Her name is Heather Lavezzo Downey, and she is with the interpretive specialist for the Historic Old Sacramento Foundation, and she's going to speak about the history of Sacramento. Her speech is "The Force of Nature and the Power of Man, Raising Sacramento, 1850 to 1870. Ms. Downey.
Thank you. And I have to say, especially thank you for getting my middle name right, Lavezzo. Most people don't say that properly. Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me. Can you all hear me okay? Okay, great. I've got it right here in front of my face. So I've actually never sat down to give a talk, so please be gracious with me as I used to like to use my hands and things when I talk. I'm here to speak to you all a little bit about what I know and have learned about the early history of Sacramento, which is this wonderful city that you have chosen to have your annual conference. I have to say that I'm probably a little biased because I do live here and I do study the history of the city for a living. Even still, I think you've made a great choice. Now, as was mentioned in my introduction, my name is Heather Lavezzo Downey, and I do work as an interpretive specialist now at the Center for Sacramento History, which is the public archive for the city and county of Sacramento. A great deal of what I do at work each day involves researching and writing for a variety of programs, such as exhibitions, interpretive signage throughout areas of our city and county, and tour programs. And I do all this work at the archive because I get to work with the collection that we care for. So each day I get to work with documents from the Gold Rush, and I get to look at pictures from the Gold Rush, and it's such a special job. And what I get to do is I have the privilege of interpreting kind of complex stories from the past and making them digestible for the diverse public that we serve in Sacramento. I really, really love what I do, and one of my favorite parts about my job is that I do get to come and speak to different groups about what I've learned, and that is exactly what I'm here to do today. I will be talking to you guys about the street raising project in Sacramento's past. The street raising project was a very massive public works project that sustained and helped to grow Sacramento in the early 1860s, and it was completed before the close of the 1870s. This street raising project was just one component of the young city's efforts to protect itself from flooding. Now, one of the long-term effects of Sacramentans choosing to raise their streets is a unique man-made landscape that characterizes downtown Sacramento to this day. This unique man-made landscape is reflective of the street raising project, and one component of the landscape is what is popularly called an underground. A city under a city, if you will, and you can actually take tours of the underground today in Old Sacramento. It's very exciting. That's actually the project that I was on in graduate school, and the tour program, I helped to write the interpretive plan for it. It served as my master's thesis project. So I think I sort of lucked out when it came to grad school. I got to write a really fun paper. So because I spent a year researching the street raising project, that's what I'm going to talk about, because it's sort of the only thing I consider myself an expert in. And I'm going to talk about why early Sacramentans decided it was a good idea to raise their entire business district and how they rationalized such a project and some of the interesting or perplexing things that happened to them because they decided to do it. Now, a side note is I feel very strongly that if you can understand and appreciate why Sacramentans raise their streets, you have a much better understanding of this city and the things that make it work to this day. But I also feel very strongly that by understanding why Sacramentans raise their streets, you can sort of apply that model to a lot of other cities in our country and around the world, because as my talk is titled, The Force of Nature and the Power of Man, because cities around the world are places where these two forces have often come together, and the cities that we call home are the product of that conflict. Now, I always like to start off by explaining exactly how Sacramentans raise their streets, because that is the biggest question I had when I got assigned the project. I thought, how did they pull this off? So there really just were a few basic steps to raising a city. So if you ever want to do it, here's how you do it. So if you could imagine that I'm a 19th century property owner, and I'm a woman, so I could own property in Sacramento from the very, very beginning. There were few limitations for people. You could own property no matter your gender, your skin color, your ethnicity, anything in Sacramento, which was a great incentive for people to come to Sacramento, not just the gold, but the fact that you could really have a lot more opportunities in Sacramento. So I'm a young woman, and I own a hat shop, and I own it on J Street, which was and is the main thoroughfare of Sacramento.
Okay, thanks.
Now, it's the early 1860s, and the Board of Trustees, which was the city council of the day, they were a bunch of businessmen who fashioned themselves as sort of the board of directors of a company, and that company was Sacramento. So they called themselves the Board of Trustees, and they have decided that, okay, Heather, the block that you own your hat shop on, it's up for the high grade. That's what they called the new street level. Now, most property owners didn't object to being told that they had to raise the street around them. They, in fact, really wanted to do it. And I'm going to get to that later about why. But there were some that didn't want to do it, a very small majority. And so the Board of Trustees said, that's fair. So if you can get two-thirds of the property owners around you to say that they don't want to raise their streets, we'll let you get away with it. But that never happened. So they were on board with this project. So the first thing I said is I would step outside my hat shop, and I would look down at the ground, and there would be a 14-foot-wide boardwalk. That was my sidewalk in front of my building. So the first step to raising the street is that I had to walk out to the edge of my sidewalk, and where the sidewalk met the muddy street, I had to start building a wall. And I built that wall out of brick, and it was as high as the Board of Trustees says the new street was going to be in front of my building. And it was as long as my property, which was typically about 20 feet. Property in Sacramento was very expensive, so it was long and narrow. So 20 feet long, it was 14 feet outside the front of my building, and it was going to be as high as the new street. And it was made of brick. Now, the next step was the job of the government. The Board of Trustees said, okay, thanks for building your wall. All of my neighbors have done it as well. So on a given city block, you know, there's 200 feet of wall on both sides of the street. They would hire teams of people with horses and wagons to bring in dirt. And they would keep bringing in dirt until the space between those two sets of brick walls were filled. It was usually about 10 feet. They got all of that dirt and sludge from mostly the American River riverbed. So to this day, our streets are still filled with the sludge from the American River. The contractors that the Board of Trustees hired were also responsible for paving the new street that they had filled. The third step was back to my responsibility. As the property owner, I had to decide if I wanted to let my building now sit below grade, because as you can imagine, the street is now 10 feet higher than it used to be, and my building is still sitting where it used to be. Most property owners decided to actually raise their buildings to the new street level, and they did this using screw jacks, technology similar today to today's car jack. And hundreds of men would be hired to come and slowly hoist my building to the new street level. Now, there was one last step to completing the street raising, and it was to top off your sidewalk, because as you can imagine, there's that 14-foot-wide space between your building, which is now sitting at the new street level, and the new street, where your sidewalk used to be. So they would top off the sidewalk with boards, just like they had at the original level, and that is essentially how you raised your business district. You built a wall, you filled in the street, you raised your building, and then you topped off the sidewalk. And so today's underground in Sacramento is essentially the basement spaces that were created to hold those new buildings up and the hollow sidewalks that exist. And you can tour them in Old Sacramento. This is how 2.5 miles of street were raised on average 9.5 feet in the 1860s and 1870s. Sacramento is the only city in California to have raised its streets, and it was the first on the West Coast. It predated Seattle by 30 years. Chicago raised its streets at the same time. They're also a Western city, but they were a little bit older than Sacramento. So I like to consider, you know, Sacramento and Chicago were sort of leading the way for this in the 1850s and 60s. Now, I've broken it down into a few simple steps, but obviously it was a huge decision and commitment to raise an entire business district. I like to imagine and have people that hear me speak imagine what it would have been like to live in Sacramento as this was going on. And in order to fully appreciate the chaos that was Sacramento during the street raising project, you have to understand where it was before they decided to raise their street raising project, before they decided to raise their streets. So a little history is that Sacramento was founded in 1850, right after gold was discovered in 1848. Sacramento was founded in 1850. It was incorporated in 1850, and California was admitted to the Union in 1850. This happened very, very quickly. And just 4 years later, Sacramento was the permanent state capital of California, which was a huge bonus for Sacramento that it got to be the capital. And Sacramento also was an instant city. You know, popular ideas about the Old West, you know, with gunslingers and saloons and dirt streets and tumbleweeds, that just wasn't true in Sacramento. Maybe for a couple months in 1849, but Sacramento became an inland metropolis, San Francisco's urban partner, almost overnight. This was a city that wanted to be a permanent world-class city. So the mythology of the West kind of wasn't true in Sacramento. By 1860, so 10 years after its founding, Sacramento was the political and economic hub of the entire Western United States. But even amidst all this success in the 1850s, it had been flooded multiple times, it had been burnt down by fire multiple times, it had to deal with a deadly riot over land rights, disease after disease kept coming in, cholera kept coming in and killing people, and Sacramento rebuilt over and over and over again. And that's one of the reasons why it got to be the state capital, is because legislators really admired Sacramentans' willingness to rebuild. They thought, this is a good place to put our capital because they really want to be the capital. So, in the beginning of the 1860s, on the eve of the street raising project being adopted, the conversation on the streets was incredibly heated because there were those within the community, a very small majority, who just didn't want to raise their streets because it was so expensive and they knew it was going to be expensive. They called themselves the low graders. And they would fight on the streets. They would have public debates. And the Sacramento Bee and the Sacramento Union newspapers would have daily reports on the public debates between the high graders and the low graders, as they would basically be fighting publicly over the pros and cons of raising the streets. So it was incredibly political, this decision. It was also very expensive. Sacramentans spent millions of their own dollars to make it happen, and they willingly taxed themselves to do part of it, and they also paid for a lot of it out of pocket. It was physically demanding because all the work was done by hand labor. We didn't have, you know, tractors to do all the digging. People had to do this by hand, and they used wheelbarrows and horse-drawn carts and shovels and picks. All of it took a long time. I mean, the project spanned the 1860s and most of the 1870s, but it could take weeks for you to find contractors to build your brick wall. It could take weeks for the city to find people to build, to fill in the streets. And it took weeks for buildings to reach their new elevation on screwjacks. It was a very painstakingly slow process. Now, 1869, about 7 years into the project, Mark Twain visited Sacramento, and he wrote, he had a lot to say about the chaos in Sacramento during the street raising project, and he made fun of the city quite a bit. And my favorite thing that he said was this: the system of raising buildings in Sacramento has its advantages. It makes the floors very shady, and this is a great thing in very warm climates. But it also enables the inquiring stranger to rest his elbows on the second-story windowsill and be able to criticize the bedroom arrangements of all the citizens. So what he's basically describing is that this city on stilts, as it was called, the construction was really haphazard. It didn't happen in a uniform manner. And a building could sit below grade for days, weeks, months at a time before the owner had enough money to raise it to the new grade. So you could be standing on the new sidewalk and be looking into the second story of a building that hadn't yet been raised. So as you can imagine, Sacramento was sort of a dangerous place to be during the construction. There are surprisingly no reported deaths, but injury was not uncommon as, like I said, the project was done haphazardly. It was so troublesome for the city's reputation that maybe property owners weren't taking the project seriously or getting it done in a timely manner that the Board of Trustees made it illegal not to at least demonstrate that you were serious about making the construction happen. We do have record of people being arrested and fined for, quote, not completing their sidewalk in time, because people could fall a feet to the original level of the city if you hadn't gotten around to topping off your sidewalk. And your neighbor might have. So if you could, you know, let's say Sacramento was the city of saloons, so there were a lot of drunk people walking around, and you're walking down the street, and it's dark, it's 1865, there's no such thing as streetlights. You just fall. People were breaking their legs left and right. It was very dangerous. And so the Board of Trustees, they just couldn't have this. It was a liability, but it was also making Sacramento look bad that their citizens weren't, you know, showing enough initiative to make it happen. On September 8, 1864, the Sacramento Bee reported that a wooden house on the south side of I Street that was occupied by Chinese immigrants. It was being lifted to the high grade on screwjacks when the people fell out of the building. I don't know why they were still in the building. I've thought about it and thought about it. But as the article relayed, none of these people were injured except for a carpenter named Brian. He was under the building when it fell, and he was just bruised about the head and the breast. So he didn't die, but the building did fall on him, and he was okay. Muddy streets, as the streets filled in with sludge from the American River, it took a while for the contractor to pave them. So muddy streets were a pervasive problem. The union actually reported that a small boy, about 5 years old, he was standing on the second-story balcony of a building at J and 8th Street, and he was, I don't know what he was doing, but nobody was watching him, because he fell off the balcony, and he, quote, probably would have been killed except for the great abundance of mud into which he fell. So Sacramento was paying a lot of money to raise their streets, and it was long, hard work, and they were being made fun of for doing it. And almost every day they were putting themselves in harm's way. So why did they do it? Well, a lot of the work that I've done and a lot of what people learn about on the tours, and this is really the thesis that I've come up with, is that they did this because Sacramentans had a vision for their city. They wanted it to grow. Like any city in the United States, even to this day, if you really think about it, your city is supposed to provide certain things for you. It's supposed to be a certain way. And the newly arrived merchants, speculators, landowners, and families who spent all of their money to come to Sacramento in the gold rush, they had no other option but to stay because they had purchased land, they had invested in the place. This city, Sacramento, was their investment. And they did everything they could during the gold rush to make sure that it was safe for them to continue living in, but more importantly, that Sacramento was attractive to trading partners and other investors who shopped in their stores, who slept in their hotels, ate at their restaurants, and purchased property. And they needed to maintain it because it was the state capital. And losing the state capital would be basically a death sentence for the city. Now, as is the case with most things related to Sacramento history, there is one guy that we can contribute this vision for economic growth to, and his name is Sam Brannan. Has anybody ever heard of Sam Brannan before? Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. He was kind of a scoundrel. He was a converted Mormon who was charged with the task of coming to California to scout out a new settlement for his church. And he took the job not because he cared about what God wanted him to do, but because he wanted to make money doing it. And he supposedly would pocket tithes. And when people, you know, sort of tried to call him out on it, he was quoted as saying that he would give God what was due to him when God gave Sam Brannan what was due to him. So he, as, you know, questionable as his ethics were, he was very much a product of his time. And he saw California as the chance to really capitalize on the up-and-coming development of the place. And when he arrived in Sacramento just before the gold discovery in 1848, Brannan knew that the land was a natural floodplain in Sacramento. But he also knew that the rivers, the Sacramento and the American, were good for transportation. And that was an incentive that he could not pass up if he were going to set up shop and become a successful merchant and sell things to all those miners who were coming into San Francisco and then taking a steamer up to Sacramento. The gold miners had no option but to stop where the Sacramento met the American before they could head up to the gold mines. In 1848, the California Star newspaper reported that Sacramento was, quote, superior as an elevated and therefore healthy position. Would it surprise you to know that Sam Brannan owned that newspaper and was also the only editor and writer that it had on staff? We all know that this was a blatant lie because Sacramento to this day still sits at the low-lying confluence of the Sacramento and the American rivers. But after the gold rush began, that did not matter. People had no option but to come to Sacramento because it was the inland gateway to the gold fields that Brannan had made sure that it would become. Over time, the city leaders changed, but this vision for growth and sort of manipulation has stuck with Sacramento, and it continued to do that through the gold rush. So after the city was officially incorporated in 1850, those who invested in Sacramento did all they could to ensure that the city's population was growing and that their property values were staying high. Men such as Hardin Bigelow, who was the first elected mayor of Sacramento, sought amenities for the city to keep commerce alive and kicking. But after the city flooded in 1850, so almost right after people started arriving, amenities began to include flood protection. So citizens built a levee, and they paid for it themselves by imposing taxes. And by the end of the 1850s, they had spent $600,000 of their own money to sustain and construct this levee over and over and over again. The levee was expensive, but it did work. Because, not because it kept floodwaters out, but because Sacramento, like I have said, was named the permanent state capital in 1854, and city dwellers were pretty confident that they had defeated nature and that they had created a safe and sustainable place to live and to do business. So in 1860, the city directory, which was kind of like the phone book of the gold rush, except for there were no phones, so it was just basically a list of who lived in the city and what they did and where they lived. It always provided a little brief history of Sacramento in the beginning, and I thought this was so telling what it had to say about itself, the city had to say about itself. Quote, 11 years ago, where Sacramento stands was an unclaimed wilderness. Today, by that indomitable energy and perseverance which characterizes the American people, we stand as the second city on the Pacific coast, and there we will stand forever. End quote. So, however confident, hopeful, and I think delusional Sacramentans were in 1860, they had a vision, and it was fully in play. Now, this mindset that nature was manageable was so foundational to motivating Sacramentans to rebuild over and over and over again in the 1850s. And it would prove absolutely necessary after 1862 when a small group of business owners decided that they were going to raise their city. Because Sacramentans got a huge reality check when a series of winter storms struck California between November and January of 1861 and 62. What began as seasonal and expected flooding in late 1861 turned to complete disaster. And all the research that I've done, this storm, coverage of it reached London. It was kind of like Hurricane Katrina, 1862 version of Hurricane Katrina. And Sacramento was the worst hit because of what it was, because it was the capital. The great storm traveled north from Southern California, and when it reached the Sacramento Valley, it dumped almost 30 inches of rain in January 1862 alone. The rains transformed the valley into an inland sea that was said to have been 300 miles long and 60 miles wide. The water was so high throughout the Sacramento and San Joaquin valleys that it covered telegraph poles, and the great storm was so powerful that it didn't stop in Sacramento. It kept going, and when it reached Tennessee on the other side of the country, it slowed troop movement during early Civil War engagements. But in Sacramento, citizens were subjected to hurricane-force winds, and they lived in 5 feet of ice-cold, muddy water. That's as tall as me. they had to use boats to get around their city, which was something they were used to, because every time the city flooded, they just brought out their boat. Almost every family in Sacramento owned a boat, because when the city flooded, that's how they got around. But this levee that they had constructed and spent all their money on in the 1850s was now an injury instead of a benefit, because it kept all the water inside the city. A chain gang, so people who had been arrested and were serving on the chain gang, one of them was charged with the unfortunate task of breaching part of that levee to relieve the water, to relieve the city of the excess water. And when the force of the rushing water came through the city, it took homes off their foundations, and that chain gang was never seen again. Perhaps most dramatically, the legislature left Sacramento, and I say that because this is what really kicked the city into high gear. People started to freak out when legislators were like, we just can't handle this anymore. We're going to San Francisco. And when it did that, it was really threatening to those who owned land here. It was taking the promise away of continued political power. A 24-year-old woman named Florence Julian lived on M Street, which is also Capitol on our city grid. She wrote a letter to her brother, who was attending university back east, and she made it through the storms of that war, but she had this to say. The whole affair was so grand, and man's efforts were so puny in comparison, that in wild abandonment, my sympathies were all enlisted in favor of the wild elements. She couldn't believe what she was seeing. These floods of 1861 and 62 were at the very least, problematic for Sacramentans who had invested in the city and had adopted this vision for growth. Their trusted levies had failed, and soon observers were questioning the city's future. A San Francisco newspaper, probably also gloating that they were now sort of the temporary state capital, said that it is simply an act of folly for the people of the town of Sacramento to endeavor to maintain their city at its present location. A Nevada newspaper said that Sacramento is doomed, and that's all they had to say on the subject. And interestingly, in March, late March 1862, the city was still underwater. I mean, the rains had gone away, but the city was still sitting in all that water. And a federal land surveyor, I found his journal at the Bancroft Library. He wrote, "I don't think Sacramento will ever rise from the shock. I just don't see how it can. Yet it has a brighter side, because no people can so stand calamity as this people. They are used to it." So even though the flooding had been devastating and outsiders were expressing little faith in the future of Sacramento after these floods, city dwellers were not willing to give up on their vision for growth. Just 2 days into the flooding, the Sacramento Bee asked its readers, "What next? Is not self-protection the first law of nature? Does not necessity demand obedience? Can we exist without a levy and a higher grade?" Just 2 days in, they were already making plans to raise their streets. And 10 years later, the Bee looked back with pride, and it said, "For men like this, the question was not whether to admit that Sacramento was located on an untenable site and just to leave, but rather to make sure that it was tenable." So to restore faith in the future of Sacramento, the city adopted three ways to defy its rivers and their tendency to flood. The first was they just couldn't get over the levees, so they kept reinforcing the levees. But they also rerouted the American River, which was typically the culprit of all the flooding, and that is a whole nother subject, how they did that. And finally, they raised their streets. So they fixed the levees, they rerouted the American River so it was less likely to flood, and they raised their business district. All of these programs permanently altered the physical landscape in Sacramento, and you can still see that today. It's here that we understand the forces of nature and the power of man colliding in Sacramento. The forces of nature were floods and sort of an inhospitable landscape for permanent settlement. But the power of man was their audacious commitment to this place and their strong desire to continue making money off the land and continuing to live here. Today in Sacramento, the legacy of this conquest of the land remains in the form of a unique downtown landscape that I've described for you. And as I've said, you can take tours of this place in Old Sacramento. Our guides lead you through the historic district, both above and below ground, and you get to experience the ways that our city still reflects what happened in the 1860s and 1870s. And guests marvel at some of the stuff that I've told you today, but I'm not going to give you all the fun facts because there are so many incredible stories about things that happened during the storm, during the flood. And it's just incredible to know that Sacramento, its city motto since 1863, when the street raising project was adopted, we are the urbs indomita, which is Latin for the indomitable city. They gave themselves this title, and we still to this day have that title. So in conclusion, I'd like to point out that even after the levees were reinforced, the river altered, and the streets raised, Sacramento continued to flood. Throughout the 19th century, all through the 20th century, and if you live in Sacramento, every winter we wonder if the next big one is coming our way. So technically, this celebrated street raising project that made Sacramento famous in its day was a complete failure. But even still, I argue that it didn't fail. It failed to keep floodwaters out, but it did exactly what those who made it, you know, law. It did exactly what it wanted them to do. It kept people in Sacramento, and the legislature came back, and it's never left since. The project convinced people to stay, to purchase land, to raise families, and invest in the city. By 1870, just 20 years after it was founded, Sacramento was a world-class city. Its buildings were permanently here, and the landscape was physical proof that they weren't going to go anywhere. The project inspired confidence in Sacramento, and I think that the ability to sponsor, to foster and create that confidence, even when compared to the horrifying power of Mother Nature, is definitely a force to be reckoned with. So I'm happy to take questions. I don't know how much time I took up, so I don't want to steal.
Well, we have a couple of minutes, I guess. Does anyone have a question?
Yes, thank you. Doug Martin from San Diego.
Hello.
Did the Civil War have any effect on the growth of Sacramento? Was there any conscription of Californians for the Union forces or any such things as that?
There was definitely actual participation of Californians in the Civil War. But California, and this is a much larger topic, California played a very pivotal role in the development of the Civil War. But what's really fun is that as you're doing newspaper research, for the example, during the floods and during the street raising, and if you look at, if you like try to think of the timeline of early Sacramento, so many changes are happening here in California as the nation is at war with itself. And Sacramento was definitely very introspective, I would say, during the street raising project, but it was very much aware of what was going on back east with the war. So the project wasn't hindered because of the Civil War, but to answer your question, yes, Sacramento played a very pivotal role in the Civil War, and especially in Union, in the development of the Union, yes. Any other questions?
Sam Chen from the Bay Area. I wonder, you know, that Sacramento is also on, I think, the earthquake zone here, and wonder if this kind of risk in the land, how you reinforce the structure to sustain the damage from the earthquake?
Earthquakes aren't a very large concern. I mean, of all the natural disasters we have to worry about in California, earthquakes definitely aren't the largest one. However, the underground, just to address you, that's a great question, because the underground spaces have been retrofitted and reinforced to meet, you know, modern day safety standards, as is law in California.
Any more?
I have a question in regards to the 1906 fire and earthquake. How did Sacramento help in when San Francisco had its turn for two big disasters?
That's a great question. That question is really astute, because it really does pick up on the fact that San Francisco and Sacramento were sort of partner cities for most of the 19th century. In fact, reports of the 1861-62 storm play into answering this question in two ways, because it allows you to realize that Sacramento today isn't. I've traveled like abroad, and nobody knows where Sacramento is, which is so funny, because, like I said, you know, London had its eye on Sacramento during the 61-62 storm, but Los Angeles was actually referred to as the Village of Los Angeles, and it was completely wiped out by the 1861-62 storm. And everybody wants to know, oh, do you live near LA? Is that the capital? No, it's not. But during the 1861-62 storm, even though San Francisco definitely was gunning for the capital to stay there, they sent shiploads of relief and aid and people to Sacramento and people were being, you know, rescued from the city and being sent to San Francisco. There was actually a really random statistic of one ship came up the river from San Francisco with 2 tons of ham. I mean, you know, it was just like, of all the things you need when you're being flooded out, ham, apparently, San Francisco. But when the 1906 earthquake happened, I don't have exact details or stories, because it's obviously out of the scope of the research for this particular project, but there was that reciprocity of aid, because for, like I said, the early years of, you know, America's presence in the West, San Francisco and Sacramento were considered themselves partner cities. One couldn't have existed without the other. That's a great question.
Thank you, Ms. Downey.
I have one more.
Excuse me, Roger. This is Gene. I was wondering if Heather could tell where the guide is that she worked on, where people could obtain it if they're interested.
Well, the interpretive plan that I wrote for the tour program is specifically for the guides and volunteers. It's a training tool. However, we sort of synthesized the information that I used for that plan, and we produced a guidebook that is for sale at the Sacramento History Museum in Sacramento, which is also where you can purchase tickets for the tour.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you for asking. Thank you very much for having me. You were a great audience.
Thank you very much for coming. Before we go on to our next item, I want to have a piece of business conducted, which needs to be conducted and was inadvertently left out of the program. As you may be aware, last night there was a nominating committee meeting, and it is only fair and just that the results of that meeting, which of course was totally secret and nobody knows anything about, be reported to this convention. So this is a little piece of the business meeting now that we are going to, and the credentials chair, the nominating committee chair, sorry, he's that too. Rob Turner will tell us the results of the nominating committee meeting last night.
Okay, and the envelope, please. Let's see. Okay, the results of the slate for the upcoming election in November are: for the second vice president position, the nominee, Roger Peterson. For the secretary, Judy Wilkinson. For the board positions, we have Artis Bazin, Foster Brown, Linda Perel, Eric Smiley, and Robert Wendt. And the way the elections work, I found out, I hadn't realized this, but in the odd-numbered years, the second VP and the secretary are elected with four board members, or five board members, and in the even-numbered years, it's the president, the first vice, and the treasurer, and then four board members. So anyway, I want to thank the committee for being a very friendly committee and for helping make the job easy. Thanks.
It was quick, too, wasn't it? It wasn't like the old days when we had till 1 o'clock in the morning. All right. The next speaker is of particular interest to me, since I have been acquainted to some degree with him for quite a number of years. And I have to say, in looking at his title and his professorship and so forth, it says, geology? What is this? Geology. The reason I say that is because way back in the 60s, when we were both still in school, I did a directory of blind college students, and I remember getting a card back from him and putting him in the directory. He was an undergraduate at Princeton at the time, and somehow I got his field of study wrong, and I got a little terse letter from him about what his major really was. It wasn't paleontology, it was paleobiology, I think was the way it went. And then in the 70s in D.C., I remember running across him again when he was teaching at the University of Maryland. We had a little natural history and ornithology and such like class for blind people there, and he spoke to us a time or two. Gerard Vermey is blind, and he is a distinguished professor of geology at Department of Geology, University of California at Davis. And he has written 6 books and about 200 articles, and has one of the things I was interested in is that he had a MacArthur fellowship. I think I know 3 or 4 people now who've had that. That's what they call the Genius Fellowship. One of the others is a person some of you know, Jim Fruchterman, who invented Bookshare. the notable thing about Gerard Vermeer is that he is an expert on shells. He can tell you. You give him a shell, and he can tell you by feeling it the total course of evolution of that organism that made that shell, or something like that. Anyway, here to speak to us about how to be a blind scientist and writer is Dr. Gerard Vermeer, Distinguished Professor of Geology, Department of Geology, University of California at Davis.
Good afternoon.
I hate microphones.
It's the only way they can hear you.
Okay, all right. I'm going to try to not do anything terrible to this thing. So I'm not going to tell you how to be a blind scientist. I'm going to tell you how I am a blind scientist, because I'm sure there are multiple ways of doing this. Before I tell you how I do science, I should tell you a little bit about what the science is. I think Mr. Peterson pointed out, I do have an expertise on shells, but shells are means to an end. I describe myself as an evolutionary biologist, paleobiologist, and I am now in a geology department, although at my time at Maryland, I was in a biology department. Yes. And in fact, both of my degrees are in biology. I say both, that meaning undergraduate degree, which is at Princeton was an AB degree, by the way. And my PhD was in biology as well at Yale. But I do both living and fossil organisms, and I write very broadly, not just about mollusks. I do actually have one book about mollusks, but most of my books are of a very general nature. I just published in late 2010 a book entitled The Evolutionary World, How Adaptation Explains Everything from Seashells to Civilization. I believe that a Brill version of that is available. I certainly have a Brill copy of it, and I think it's going to be made available. One of my previous books, an autobiography, is available from NLS. It's called Privileged Hands, A Scientific Life. And the other books are of a generally more technical nature, but I hope and believe still somewhat readable. So I do everything from comparing human and natural economies to thinking about patterns in history to evolutionary trends to patterns of species invasion. We have an article about to come out in Nature about this. I study extinction. I study how organisms are adapted to their circumstances. So my interests are extremely broad. I teach all kinds of things. I teach an introductory evolution course at UC Davis. I also teach a course called The History of Ecosystems, which I just finished in the winter quarter. And now I'm doing two seminars, one on gigantism in fossils, and the other one is going through my book and talking about all the things that it brings up. So that's in a rather small nutshell what I do, at least what the kind of science I do. Now the question is, how do I do it? And it will perhaps come as a big surprise to you that I'm a bit of a Luddite, in the sense that to my mind, what's really important in science is how to ask questions and how to try to find answers to them. I think 90% of success in science is the ability to ask the right questions. And by the right questions, I mean two things. One is they have to be important questions. And secondly, they have to be answerable. I can ask all kinds of questions to which there cannot really be answers. And I can also ask all kinds of questions that are completely irrelevant. And I have to say that I've asked plenty of those in the past myself. because some of what I do, quite a lot of what I do, is of no interest to anyone. So, for example, right now I'm engaged in a three-author, very large monograph on the classification of the subfamily Fasciolariidae that will possibly be read by one or two other people in the world, but maybe not. But the point is that if you don't do this kind of work, then you can't get more general either. So to do this kind of scut work is absolutely essential. So I like to think that I am the world expert on a couple of truly minor things, and I also like to think that by being an expert on these things and by reading broadly, I can put those trivial things into a larger context. And I think that's absolutely essential to be a successful scientist. But again, it's asking the questions that's really important. And for that, one needs an intellect. One doesn't necessarily need technological prowess. Moreover, science has more and more become a very collaborative effort, so that if there are, for example, molecular phylogenies to be done, I'm happy to have a student or a colleague do it. I don't think I need to learn the techniques myself, although I do need to understand the assumptions behind the techniques. That's very important.
Yes.
So, science has been part of my life since the earliest days of my memory, basically even before I became blind. I became blind at age 3, officially. I never could see very well at all, but all my education has been as a totally blind person. But I have always been interested in science, and I think this is largely due to my parents, who, although by no means educated at a university level, were always keen natural historians, as was my brother, as is my brother, who lives in the Netherlands, by the way. And so science was something I was going to do from a very early age. And so when I went to Princeton, I became a biology concentrator, as they say there. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I always wanted to become a professor. So I did exactly that. I've been doing it for 40-odd years. Starting very, very young, because I sort of whizzed through my undergraduate and PhD degrees. Since I've always wanted to be a natural historian, that is to say, I'm a lover of nature, because I also was really interested in larger questions in science, I've always done a great deal of field work. Field work meaning, in my case, everything from investigating rainforests in tropical America to mangroves all over the world to extremely, and I mean extremely dangerous, rocky shores in various places. I'll tell you about that more in a microsecond. Cold waters in the Aleutian Islands, to coral reefs where one can be bitten and stung in various ways, which I've had a fair bit of experience with also. I take risks, plenty of them, because without taking risks, you don't really go anywhere. And let me tell you, I mean, I mentioned a moment ago these dangerous rocky shores. I was on a ship once in the northern Marianas, of which the best-known island is Saipan. But this was an uninhabited one, called Pagan, north of Saipan. And I very much wanted to look at this lava boulder shore, and it was extremely wave-washed. And you couldn't land there. We went in this little skiff from the ship, and the guy who was running the ship said, "Now, when I tell you to jump, you jump." And I trusted him because he was a very, very capable sailor. So I jumped and indeed got onto the shore. And then I wondered, how in the hell am I going to get back? but I did, and also through his excellent guidance. Likewise, in the Aleutians, if you fall into that water, you're dead in 4 minutes because it's so cold. We got all kinds of very fancy Coast Guard garb in order so he could see you if you were about to fall in the water. Enfin, that worked out beautifully as well, in spite of some trepidations on the part of the University of Alaska who ran that particular research ship, but there was no problem with that either. And so I've had tons of experience all over the world, and this sounds like something a blind person ought not to be doing, but quite frankly, it's not that hard. The thing that you don't do, absolutely don't do, is you don't go alone. I no one who does field work in biology or geology, for that matter, no one should go alone, because there are too many things out there that can hurt you. Everything from humans, and we've had plenty of experience with that also, to natural things. Actually, I find the humans by far the scariest. We've been arrested a few times and so on. So no one should ever go alone. And in fact, in the last many years, I've mostly traveled with my wife. But one time I was at a United Nations conference in Fiji, a UNESCO conference about reefs. And we went to this really small island called Ravuni. And Ravuni had a chief. In fact, we had to go through a kava ceremony in order to work there, which is fascinating in its own right. Everyone else is going diving. Well, I don't dive because I want to keep my hearing. But I did want to look at the coast. And so we inquired as to whether there would be anyone in the village who would be willing to take me. And a 14-year-old boy said yes. And he was superb, absolutely superb. And so I've had assistance of all kinds over the years. Never to bad effect, I have to say. They've all been wonderful. In Singapore once I had a man who spoke fluent English, Chinese, and Malay. Wonderful guy, anyway. And so it's been this way throughout my entire career. Nowadays, I still do field work. In fact, I was just in Portugal a few weeks ago, working there and taking part in a PhD defense of one of my co-advisees. But nowadays, I do a lot of work in museums as well. Research museums, the back rooms, which are much more fascinating than the front rooms are. In fact, I'm currently on a board of trustees at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco as a science trustee. I've worked in museums all over the world, including the Smithsonian, which is probably the best one I've ever been to. But also Natural is in Leiden in the Netherlands, a wonderful museum, Philadelphia, New York, Sydney, Tokyo, and so on. So, again, you can't do that without assistance, because you do need to look at specimens and you need to what the labels say and so on and so forth. I also do an enormous amount of work in the library. In fact, I read vast amounts of stuff. You know, if you're going to be writing scientific papers and books, you have to cite other people's work. And in order to do that, you have to read and read and read some more. So on average, as a rough average, I read about 10 publications a week. How do I do that? Well, I don't wait until somebody records it for me or puts it in Braille. No way. There is someone who works with me half-time at the university, and my wife does an awful lot as well. They read, and I take copious Braille notes so that I now have a vast, I mean vast, Braille library of tens of thousands of papers and books that I have read in many languages. And it is these that I use for my scholarly work, and of course I keep on adding to it. And this is the way I do things, and it has worked extraordinarily well. So I have essentially, I started doing this in high school, and so I now have about 50 years worth of scientific literature in Braille, all copied by myself, essentially. So it works wonderfully well. I tell you what the advantages are to doing it this way. Number one, if I listen to a recording, I don't know how anything is spelled. Well, in the languages that I read and in the technical literature I read, I need to know how to spell things. How do we spell Chasmaporthetes, for example?
Say what?
That's a fossil genus of hyena, by the way. And so on. And of course, I can ask a live person. And by the way, not a small advantage was that I met my wife as a reader. At Yale, yeah. And we've been going at it for 38 and a half years. The other advantage is that I don't want to read the whole thing. I want to read, you know, what I need. I don't want to look through the whole bibliography. Could you tell me what's this reference? And somebody can do that. Let's save enormous amounts of time. Plus, it is pleasurable. You can laugh at somebody with somebody else, you know, and you can say, oh, this is a great paper, this is an awful paper, and so on. So it's much more fun this way. And that's why a live person reading all this technical stuff is absolutely the only way in which I could do what I do. Writing manuscripts. I have discovered that for me, let me just precise this by saying that the main criterion for an adaptation in organisms is that it work.
Yes.
It has to be sufficient. It has to work. So it doesn't have to be perfect. So having said that, what I do in writing is the following. I type, I first of all compose everything in Braille after numerous drafts. When I feel ready, I type it. My assistant puts it into the computer, scans it in the computer, edits my mistakes and other things that may be needing edited, and then I send it off to whatever publisher I choose to go to or whatever needs to be done. It then comes back often with severe criticisms, and I revise it in the same way. And although this may sound very Luddite, it works extremely well. And all I can say is people who think they can do it better, you can't argue with success. I'm not saying I'm the best scientist in the world, but I am saying I'm one of the most productive in my department. And, you just can't argue with that. So I work. Obviously, I have tremendous curiosity. In fact, if one wants to be a scientist, I think curiosity is the first thing I look for. Absolutely essential. You have to have a burning curiosity about how the world works. You have to be able to work very, very hard. I think hard work is about half of what it takes. Curiosity, the ability to ask proper questions, the ability to write, and moderately quickly, because if you don't write, you don't do anything in science. There's this sort of pejorative phrase of publish and perish. I don't think of it that way at all. I think of it as publish and do well, is how I think of it. And it is true that if you don't publish, well, then you won't go anywhere. But publishing is such a pleasurable thing to do that I can't imagine why people don't want to do it, frankly. It's a wonderful feeling to have something come out and have people comment on it and cite it and so on. It's a really very... I have to say, altogether, being a scientist for me has proven to be just the most wonderful, wonderful career I could ever have imagined, and it remains so. Let's see. So I maintain a gigantic research collection, most of which I've collected for myself, fossil and living living mollusks in the form of shells then. Each of the lots, as we call them, is labeled with a Braille label, so I know what I'm looking at. I do identification as well as I can. Occasionally, I have actually people come visit my collection and work in it, and they can tell me what they think something is. Occasionally, I tell them what I think something is. But it's always, as in any museum, it's a collection in progress. A lot of it's unidentified. You'd be astonished at how many things are unidentified in the great museums, drawer after drawer after drawer, full of lots. Nobody knows what it is. and that's true in my collection as well. someday, maybe I'll figure it out, maybe I won't. But in any case, it's very essential for me to have this collection because I get a great deal of scientific inspiration from examining this and thinking about it a great deal. I spend, by the way, a tremendous amount of time thinking about things. I'm not one of these professors who, in my mother's words, goes around like a chicken without a head, going to meetings and feeling important. I spend an awful lot of time just thinking. So besides that, of course, I do teach, fortunately not too heavily, but what I do, I enjoy a great deal. I enjoy lecturing, as you probably can imagine by now. I fortunately, at UC, as well as at the University of Maryland, you have teaching assistants who will read student papers. I read some, too. Can't say I enjoy that hugely, but pretty awful sometimes. What is a great deal of fun, though, for me is having graduate students. I've had about 15 PhDs over the years. I have three at the moment, I think. Is that right? Three? Two? Three? I don't know. One of whom is very close to finishing. That's a very enjoyable thing because you see people grow. And several of my students, former graduate students, have done very well. One of them is the chairman of biology at Brown University. One of them is a curator of the California Academy of Sciences. A pure coincidence, by the way. No, truly, I'm not joking there. It really is a coincidence. And I have a curator at the Provincial Museum in Victoria in Canada, and several others are quite notable. I have a man who's just now getting tenure at the University of South Florida. So several of my students have done extremely well. And that is a very enjoyable part. So is finding the odd undergraduate who really has curiosity and a great deal of interest. That's also a very enjoyable part of the work.
Yes.
In terms of what I do as a service, you know, at the university you're supposed to do research, teaching, and service. Well, my service is a little bit thin, I'm afraid. I see most of my service is outside the university. So, for example, I've been the editor of two major scientific journals, Evolution and Paleobiology, as well as of a third, a rather more minor journal called The Villager. It's a journal on mollusks. I have served on various boards, including this present situation at the California Academy of Sciences. I'm on an advisory committee at the National Science Foundation, having to do with the environment. The one thing I haven't done very much of, today being a minor exception, I haven't been a terribly good advocate or activist, in particular not about the blind. I have no problem with doing it. It's just that I want to be part of the real world, and I have, on the whole, devoted or channeled my energies into being the best scientist I can be. And I think that's rather, perhaps selfishly, but I would like to think that that's an important thing to do, to show, in other words, that with hard work and other favorable situations, one can be a very successful and very happy, that's most important of all, very happy blind scientist. Well, I've babbled enough. I would love it if we had some option. I brought some fossil shells with me, and if people would like to have a look at some of these things, I don't have any objection to that. I don't know whether there's a break coming up or not. If you have any sense, there would be. But anyway, I would entertain.
Oh dear.
I would entertain questions.
Okay, Dr. Verme, I'm going to assert my privilege as presiding officer here to ask you one that that's just totally off the wall, I guess, except that it occurred to me. You mentioned not diving because you need your hearing. In my somewhat less successful pursuit of graduate education than yours, I was interested in echolocation, and I got involved in looking at dolphins and things, and I wondered whether you could make an underwater hearing system for a blind person based on the fact that whales have their hearing mechanisms separated, acoustically isolated from the skull, so that you don't just get skull conduction, and so you could have some kind of earphones that actually work underwater well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't, I have to say. I would say, though, that the problem isn't the conduction through the skull. The problem is in pressuring your ears and damaging your eardrums.
The eardrums are made for air conducting.
So, yeah, that's true. But if you're a human diving into water, yeah. You're not going to be able to solve that problem very easily, I don't think. I have actually been interested in various forms of sensation. I actually wrote a paper, I haven't demonstrated this yet to you today, but I am sort of well known in the scientific community for making puns. And so one of my papers published last year, I called Sound Reasons for Silence. And the question I wanted to answer was, why don't mollusks, and a lot of other animal groups either, use sound for communication? And so I'm not going to, you know, babble about that very much. But I've thought about these things, and I have certainly thought about the evolution of echolocation, which is also done in air, as you may know. It's done by various moths, bats. A couple of nocturnal birds do it as well. Probably a lot more than we now think, actually.
Blind people.
I'm sorry?
And even people.
And even blind people. Yeah, I always point that out, you know. And to folks who work on echolocation, that comes as a bit of a surprise to them. Yeah.
Okay, do we have any other questions? Ed, are you there?
I'm Sam Chen. I think that I'm interested in something maybe no one in the world, you know, care about that. And maybe you are not interested in answering that to me, but I'll ask anyway. To me, a blind person, you know, the plant don't move, and animals, they move. They
right.
don't move.
Some do anyway.
The world,
yeah.
yeah. And, you know, my question is, you know, are these two were categories of the biology beings here, did they evolve from the same origin? Yes, you know, how did one turn into that and the other one turn into animals?
Well, it's a big question, obviously. Yes, they did all come from, ultimately, from a single ancestor. That's sort of one of the tenets of the theory of evolution. What's interesting is that this did not just happen once. So, for example, an awful lot of mobile animals eventually evolved into sessile ones. Think of corals, think of mussels, which are not
barnacles.
And barnacles, yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, so there's numerous examples of organisms that have gone sessile. And I might also add, just for the sake of being contrary, I suppose, that there are plants, although they don't move from place to place, there are certainly parts of plants that move quite readily. Think of tendrils, think of leaves that go along with the sun, and flowers that turn with the sun. So there's plenty of mobility actually in plants, and this is just one of a thousand dimensions along which organisms vary, and it's part of that diversity of life, that enormous variety, that I find enormously intriguing.
Two questions. When was the first amino acid, and when was the first amino acids concatenate with each other?
Right. Well, of course, we don't have a fossil record of amino acids, but we do have a general sense that the first living thing means that would be after. I mean, amino acids can occur in a non-biological context, so they're probably as old as, you know, many, many, many billions of years old. But the first life, as we now understand it, is about 3.5 billion years old. Some people think as early as 3.8. I'm not completely convinced by those claims. I usually just say about 3.5.
Also, I would like to introduce you to our treasurer, Mr. Pardini, who is an expert on shells, too. He has been placing that shell game to keep us afloat for many years.
All right, do we have, let's see, I guess we have time maybe for one more question.
Gary, this is Brian Bashan, San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind.
Well, hi Brian, we know each other, yes?
Yes, I recall in Privileged Hands, your autobiography, once upon a time you were a client with the New Jersey Commission for the Blind.
Yes.
And we've had some discussion here in California because if a high school senior is bright enough and talented enough to get into the University of California, Berkeley or Davis, where you teach, the policy, the current policy of the Department of Rehabilitation is to support them at their local community college, like Sacramento City College. Mm. I wonder, as somebody who's interested in the path of young, bright people going into science, particularly young blind people, what do you think of this policy, and what would you advise the department?
Right. Well, nothing against the community colleges. They obviously serve an enormous population. But my advice to students, no matter what level they are, is go to the best place you possibly can go. And the reason is not just for people like me who are faculty members. It's for your fellow students. So when I was an undergraduate, of course, I was very fortunate in getting into Princeton. And obviously I had wonderful faculty members, some of whom remain friends to this day. In fact, my new book is dedicated to two of them. But I spent most of my time with my student colleagues, some of whom have turned into major scientists. And this was at least as valuable as the faculty. So going to a good place, not only do good places have lots of resources, academic resources, that intellectual climate is second to none. So I would say they should not be encouraged to go to the lowest possible place. They should be encouraged to go as high as they possibly can.
Well, Dr. Verme, thank you very much for your talk today. Yeah. It has been very interesting to me, and I'm sure to a lot of other people. And
I might be so bold as to say I'm going to be getting out of here in about 15 minutes. If people would like to talk to me outside this room,
yeah, right out the.
You got 15 or 20 minutes to do it.
Very good. Thank you. That is really appreciated. That's actually very much appreciated, I'm sure. I want to thank you, and I want to wish you well with the remainder of your career, having followed you for some time. The next item on our program is a discussion of service animals, effects of the new ADA regulations, and there have been some significant changes in the ADA regulations regarding service animals, what a service animal is, and so on. The people who are going to tell us about that are from an organization called Disability Rights California. Disability Rights California used to be called Protection and Advocacy Incorporated, I believe. And it is one particular instance of a network. Hello, am I still there?
No, yes, you are.
Of a network of things called protection and advocacy systems all over the country that were defined in several pieces of legislation back in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, I think, including the Developmental Disabilities Act and so on. And I believe that there's a point in the a piece in the ADA. So these folks are there. They have a federal mandate to provide assistance and services to folks with disabilities. And as far as I know, they do it. And here's one instance of that. We have Fred Nissen, attorney, Bay Area Regional Office of Disability Rights California, Oakland, California, and Stuart Seaborn, managing attorney, Sacramento Regional Office of Disability Rights California. Are you guys there? Ready?
We're here. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Stuart, and this is Fred. We're from Disability Rights California. As you guys have mentioned, we're a statewide nonprofit disability rights organization. We receive money from the federal government and the state of California. We cover a wide range of disability issues. We're kind of cross-disability, including issues related to the blind community. Sometimes we litigate, although due to our limited resources, we can't litigate in every situation, so we often do what's called counsel and advice, where we provide advice to folks who are going to advocate for themselves, and there are plenty of successful advocates in the blind community who we've worked with, and also advocates who we've, or consumers who we've litigated on behalf of, so it runs the gamut. And we've been asked to give you our thoughts on the new Title II and Title III ADA regulations, and we have a few. But we wanted to actually go over a little bit about what these regulations apply to and what they don't apply to. Title II of the ADA is it's something we work with a lot at Disability Rights California. It applies to public entities. So it's any state or local government, a county entity, a city park, a police department, the DMV, it could be a government department. And so it's really kind of the actions of a public entity. Title III applies to public accommodations, and for me that's really a misnomer. I spent the first couple years doing this work confused by what a public accommodation was. It has the word public in it, so I thought, it could be like a public entity, like my city. But it's not. It's actually the exact opposite. A public accommodation is essentially a private business or private organization that opens its doors to the public. And it could be like a store, like a retail store, a restaurant, a museum. It doesn't have to be a for-profit organization. It doesn't have to be a for-profit business. And I was surprised and at times somewhat concerned to know that Disability Rights California, as a private nonprofit, is a public accommodation, so we could be sued. And I'd be happy, I guess, if we had a violation that someone would sue us. But it was an eye-opener because the term public accommodation, I always thought the word public would apply to public entity. It's actually private businesses or private organizations that are open to the public. So that's the area covered by the new regulations. It's essentially just public entities and public accommodations, and that leaves some gaps. There's fair housing law, which is covered by the Fair Housing Act, and there are actually different rules in certain circumstances for service animals under the Fair Housing Act, and we may talk about some of those today. Also, employment is not covered by Title II or Title III. It's covered by Title I of the ADA, and although there are some similarities in terms of some of the regulations we've seen with Title I and Title II, these new regulations do not apply to employment. So it's really public accommodations, which are essentially private businesses. See, I'm getting confused already. Private businesses open to the public and public entities. And as many of you know, and I think that's why we're here, the most kind of discussed change in the new regulations applies to service animals and the definition of a service animal. And Fred's going to talk to you a little bit about our thoughts about that, and then I'll come back.
The new regulations change the definition of service animal substantially. Before the amendments, any animal that was trained to help a person with a disability could potentially be a service animal. Now, under Title II and III, only a dog could be a service animal. With this more exception of a miniature horse, which I've never seen one, but if it is one, it could be an animal.
There must be a strong miniature horse lobby.
Well, there are actually programs that are attempt to train them in that regard, yeah.
But the whole miniature must be individually trained to perform a task for the individual with a disability. Therefore, the animal that somebody needs because it provides them with support, emotional support. I think these regulations, they are not ever. This is a one of the big differences now between the ADA and the Fair Housing Act. And the Fair Housing Act, you can't have a support animal. Now, that doesn't mean that an individual with psychiatric disability can never have a service animal. It means that person would have to have a dog that trained to help them do a particular task, such as preventing or interrupting impulsive rejection. government behavior over my minute between May 8th or summer at Jamaica or government meeting. If it's time to do that,
So one of the things that the new regs kind of raised for us is really kind of the difference between state and federal law. And for the most part, the individually trained requirement that a service animal has to be individually trained is the same under state and federal law. And as Fred said, there is a difference in terms of fair housing law, which allows for comfort or support animals. But under the ADA Title One and two, I'm sorry, Title Two and Three, you do have this individually trained requirement that would eliminate coverage of just support animals. But the state differs in certain ways, so I wanted to kind of go over the way we see the hierarchy of federal and state law. Under the ADA, the ADA allows a state to essentially make laws about disability rights, but the state's law has to offer as much protection and no less. So the state can always offer more protections for disability rights, but it can never offer less. So California, in its agriculture code, has a certification process and program that the counties can develop and are authorized to do so. So like if you know, say you're in the county of Santa Barbara, you can go to the county and apply for a certification for your service animal and get an ID tag. And we often get calls from consumers, you know, I'd like to go to my store, I've gotten some questions, would I be better off with this ID tag? And it's kind of a judgment call. You know, on the one hand, we want to tell people, well, the ADA doesn't require any kind of certification, so you shouldn't have to. But at the end of the day, it's that person that's got to go into that store, and they may feel more protected with that ID tag. So what we can tell people is that, no, there is no requirement for a certification for your service animal. There's no, you know, you don't have to show the tag, you don't have to have a certificate. But given that the state has this program, it may essentially keep folks off of our backs. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But the new regs specifically do not require you to have a certification for your service animal. And actually that portion of the California Agriculture Code that has this authorization and certification process says if this limits any protections granted by the ADA, the limits don't apply. So it is essentially a floor. The ADA is a floor for protection that the state can provide as much protection or more, but no less. Another difference between state and federal law that applies to service animals, and it's governed by a couple of these California codes, is the protection for a service animal in training. And here's one where, because there's no discussion under the ADA of a service animal in training, the state law is actually better. The state, the California and several other states allow you to bring a service animal in training in public accommodation, and you can essentially take that service animal anywhere that any other service animal could go. The only caveat is because there's no federal discussion of it, the state can require a certification. So if it's a service animal in training, it definitely does have to have that ID tag or certification. But that's one additional, we'd call it an additional protection. But at the end of the day, if you're looking, if you're on the Department of Justice website and you're looking at these DOJ regulations, you should know that they're a floor for protection. The state can offer more protection, it just cannot offer less. I'm going to turn it back to Fred.
Okay. The new regulations specifically says what you can be asked if you don't do what says no. They can only ask you if you is the animal required by a disability? And the other was in the big and work at does it perform any objective but cannot act like what is a disability? You do not have to tell them where did they get the dough frame? They can't act there. But on the surface, even if the door is trained to do a particular task for a disability, it still may have the right to exclude the animal only if the animal is out of control and the owner can't get control of it. It requires that the animal be within the owner's control at all times. And B, if the dog is not broken, if the dog relieves itself on the floor, that evidence that it's not outbroken. They can make you take it out. But the only reason that if I would take it out, and the public accommodation does not have to take care of it. Doesn't have a fear, doesn't have a watch, but the person's responsibility. Now, what happens if the public accommodation denies them?
This is one of my favorite portions of California state law, because here we really do offer more protections, and you guys are very lucky to be living in the state of California. And the first kind of indicator of that is the California Penal Code, essentially the criminal remedies. Under the state of California Penal Code, it's a crime or a misdemeanor to deny access to a service animal. And so if you can show somebody, even without intent, if they denied you legitimate or rightful access to your service animal, to a public accommodation or a public entity, the person can be charged with a criminal violation, a misdemeanor, and a $2,500 fine. It's rarely enforced. I know of one situation, and it's in El Dorado County, for those folks who are curious. But I think it's a powerful tool. And we've had one gentleman who although they didn't get the law enforced, had a police report describe the incident, and it's certainly been very helpful in our civil pursuit of the incident, because it certainly documents what the store owner or the store clerk is doing, and that stuff is priceless. If the person intentionally denies a service animal, and so the person knows it's a legitimate service animal, say they've asked the questions that Fred has described, and the only two questions they can ask, and the person with the service animal has given legitimate answers to the point where the other person should have knowledge, you know, they reasonably should know the legitimate service animal, it's a service animal the person has a right to have. That person, because of their intent, can go to jail. So there's a maximum 6-month jail time for intentionally denying access to a service animal under the California Penal Code. I have never seen this enforced, but it's good to know about. The other thing, as a civil attorney, that makes me happy in terms of this situation is monetary damages. And once again, we're fortunate to live in the state of California. You cannot, under Title II and Title III, sue for monetary damages. I'm talking about the ADA, the federal law, when someone denies access to your service animal. But the state law does allow you to. And there are two relevant statutes. One is the Disabled Persons Act. Under the Disabled Persons Act, you can get $1,000 per violation. So every time you walked up to that store with your service animal and they denied you, boop, that's a $1,000 violation. Under the UNRUH Act, it's even better. You can get up to 3 times actual damages, no less than $4,000 per violation. So these are powerful remedies. I'm actually glad. I mean, as Fred has described, the kind of in training or individually trained requirement that the ADA has, it's nothing really new. But for us, it's very good that everything is nice and codified, and it's on ADA.gov. It's very clear and easy for people to have access to, and that way that there's going to be no real argument by the business community that there's no notice. And as civil attorneys, we may be able to argue that, look, everybody's aware and these damages portions should be enforced. I did also want to note that the California Attorney General under state law has authority to bring suit and seek damages, so you can also file complaints with them. You can file complaints with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. You can file a complaint with the Department of Justice, and you can contact us. And like I said, our resources are limited, but in some cases we do litigate against entities that deny access to service animals. We had a recent settlement with Kaiser Permanente in Southern California, and so it certainly wouldn't hurt to call. We could provide counsel and advice at a minimum, and these are new regs, and I'm hoping more folks in our agency are interested in the issue, and so I certainly wouldn't hesitate to call. That's true.
San Diego, open Marine County.
So, do folks have any questions for us?
I have, again, the presiding officer gets to be first. I want to ask you as an attorney about the issue of criminal penalties. The reason is I have... You know, in California, we've had, since the 1960s, criminal penalties for drivers running over pedestrians in crosswalks, and that doesn't seem to help. So I just wonder if that really is a helpful thing, because they never enforce them. It seems as though the police always think that the blind person's at fault whenever there's a blind person in a car come in contact with each other, and therefore it wouldn't be fair to arrest a person on a criminal charge.
So your hit on it is very similar to many people in our agency and many advocates we've talked to. One thing I'd say is that it certainly is a good deterrent. If it happens to one business in the community, it's probably a good deterrent for other businesses. The other thing is the documentation that can come out of a police report. I mean, sometimes neither the police officer nor the store owner know. They may know now that these regs are very public, but they don't know what the rights of the individual with the service animal are, and sometimes they'll make the most horrific admissions that we can later use in a civil action. So I agree with you. It hasn't. I mean, I really haven't seen it enforced. But to the extent you can use it, I mean, if it's an egregious situation, you want to use all remedies. And at a minimum, the police report might be able to help.
Thank you. Hi, Stuart. Good to meet you, Margie Donovan. I've been a service animal user until recently for 30 years, and I have a couple of questions for you. One is regarding the certification process. What does that entail, and is there a list somewhere that covers what counties currently offer it?
I'm actually less familiar with the certification process, partially because we're relying on this federal minimum that doesn't require certifications. So I don't know much about the county process. We kind of go back and forth when someone calls our office about it, because we don't want you know, we don't want business owners to think it's required, and therefore everybody would have to have it. But at the same time, we know people want to be protected from harassment, and so it's kind of a, you know, it's a balancing act. I know that the Department of Consumer Affairs collects data on this stuff, so they might be the best source. But unfortunately, I really don't have that much information about the actual certification process itself. And Fred, you can help me with this.
In and I believe it may be on the Department of Consumer Affairs website where you can contact.
I would agree that's probably the best source.
Department of Consumer Affairs, okay. And then finally, I have a comment and a final question. I know of an ideal case in the Bay Area where a person was discriminated against taking her seeing eye dog on East Bay Paratransit. The police officer was aware. It was a service animal. The driver was aware. So we should talk about that offline. That's pretty pathetic. But
that is a complicated issue.
Say that again?
That is a complicated issue.
Right. Then my final question, and I'll release the mic, is sometimes we find ourselves in a situation where we might be working our service animal, but need to have a non-disabled person take our service animal. For example, in our ski program that I ski with, we have people that come and walk our animals for us while we're out skiing. What are the laws around access to for people around that? Because we've had some challenges. Is that clear?
Just so I understand the question, this is something that you need to do with your service animal, and you're using somebody's assistance who is not necessarily the person with a disability?
That is correct.
So it's a little complicated, and it really depends on the facts. But if you can show that the whatever you need to do is necessary for you to maintain your service animal, and the animal itself is an accommodation for your disability, you may be able to make a reasonable accommodation argument generally, and not necessarily related to the service animal, but for your general needs. But it's a tricky fact, you know, kind of case by case factual scenario. So I would encourage you, if that happens again, to give us a call, and we can kind of try and flesh it out.
Thank you.
My name is Shirley, and one of the challenges that seems to be growing by leaps and bounds as I'm working with my service animal is animals that are clearly not trained, that are on, for example, public transportation, ill-behaved, and interfering with my service animal's safety, never mind ability to do its job properly. There are laws in California that levy heavy fines on someone who fraudulently represents their pet as a service animal. One, has that ever been attempted to be litigated? And two, is there something we can do as handlers in order to try to fix this? It's getting huge. Also, the issue of those tags you mentioned, you can purchase these tags on the internet for your pet. So now we're in a real sticky wicket. What can we do?
So I think you've raised a pretty serious concern that a lot of folks have raised, and I actually think that's one of the motivations for these new regulations, because there is that individually trained requirement in there. And you're absolutely right about the California law, that there is that fraud provision. It's under the same group of penal code sections. And essentially, if you misrepresent that your animal is a service animal and it's not, then you can be fined. It's a really tough situation, and you know, it's actually a tough thing to even talk about in the disability community. I mean, we're in kind of one community here, and we can kind of talk about it, you know, at this table. But there are other disability groups that we deal with, and so there's a balancing act in terms of, you know, emotional support animals versus trained animals for people with a variety of different types of disabilities. But one thing I can tell you is if your service animal is being distracted, or there's something that the other animal is doing to your service animal so that it's interfering with your rights to have your service animal there, then that in itself, you know, that it's the owner of the public accommodation or the public entity has a responsibility to ensure that you have access to things with your service animal, and that may be the basis for the complaint.
The challenge I've run into is in Los Angeles, our transit MTA says that they are still regulated by transit, not by Department of Justice, and that their regulations have not yet changed, and therefore...
MTA.
Okay, thank you. Where do we go?
Yes.
If I'm on an MTA bus and the operator's doing nothing about this snarly dog... that is being allowed on the bus, and they say, sorry, there's nothing we can do. They say it's their service animal, and we're still regulated by other entities. Where do I go with that?
Yeah.
Well, you raised a really important point that we actually forgot to mention, so I'm so glad that you did.
Oh,
there are transit regulations under the Department of Transportation that apply to transit, whereas these do not apply. So even if it is a public entity's transit, the transit regulations apply. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you've raised probably one of the most complicated and tricky situations that we encounter, and we do encounter this. There is federal oversight. The Department of Transportation does have its complaint process, but and Fred, you can help me with this, but I'm a little bit at a loss because there are some protections that are out there, folks who have, you know, the psychiatric service animals and others, and it's a balancing act. And unless that it can be shown that it's not a legitimate service animal on the other end, it's very tough.
Now, it's government regulations. The point that the other woman brings up is that it should be fine if the pilot lands it. They've been paid law, but said that they do not have to provide any accommodation.
So
the federal transit agency is the it's a new regulation that would change that, but it's taken about 5 years and they still haven't issued them.
So if it is MTA, I would go ahead and file a Justice Department
complaint. Right.
But as Fred says, we actually made comments. I assume a lot of folks in the blind community made comments to the transportation regs. We're still waiting, so we'll see.
We're going to have to move on, I'm afraid. Do we?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. Are our Kaiser people here?
Yes.
I'm told that there are three of them. Is that right? We've had a lot of discussions with Kaiser Permanente. Of course, it's an 800-pound gorilla when it comes to health care plans. And one provides a lot of service to a lot of people. To talk about Kaiser Permanente and access for people with disabilities, it's just good business. We have Anthony Donaldson, and who is a I'm not quite clear on the specialties here, but it says he's an environmental health and safety person. Scott Goodrich, who is a pharmacy person, so that's I assume would be having to do with prescription labeling and so on. And Angel Torrance, who is a member services person, so from Kaiser Permanente. And I would like to give the turn the microphone over to them and let them present as they wish.
Thank you very much, and we're very honored to be here with you today. I've been here and visited with you some years ago. It's been a number of years, but I've been actually part of this program. So I see some familiar faces. So and hello to all of you, and thank you for inviting all of us here from Kaiser Permanente. I'm Anthony Donaldson, and yes, I work with National Environmental Health and Safety in our group, and but I had done some work in the past with our Health Access ADA compliance group, and Natasha Law was not able to be here today, and I actually live here in Sacramento, so she asked if I could come and give an overview and participate here with Scott Goodridge and Angel Torrance. So I'm here to give you an overview of kind of where things are and have been historically with the health access programs at Kaiser Permanente. As you know, a few years ago, we decided to look diligently at our access to all our care. We want to make sure that we have all our members that are able to receive an affordable, high-quality health care, and including our members with disabilities. And we began to focus with the help and input from the vendors and members and community groups on developing some internal programs to help us improve the services through five basic programs to ensure that we provide equal access to facilities and services for members with disabilities. So the five programs that we have in place internally so that we can focus on ensuring equal access to all our facilities and services include architectural access, accessible medical equipment, communication access solutions. We changed some policies and procedures within our organization to ensure access, and we also focus on training and education for our staff. So I'm going to speak to you briefly about those programs, and then Angel and Scott will be able to share a little bit more about the areas that they're in, pharmacy specifically and member services. We worked with some external vendors some years ago to help us identify a number of the barriers in our facilities and services, as well as getting a lot of input from the community. And in regards to architectural access, we've identified a number of barriers and have put in a number of programs in place to try to remove those barriers. Some of those barriers here are physical barriers, looking at ensuring that the path of travel is clear, looking at some changes in elevation, signage, countertops, parking, ensuring that countertops are at the right height for some of our members who are wheelchair users. And a lot of these things also have translated into the designs for new buildings that we may be doing in the future. So there's a number of things that we've learned from that we want to make sure they're included in those templates. Additionally, when we've made these design changes or made some modifications to our current buildings, we want to make sure they stay in place. So there's been a number of trainings and documents that have been prepared for our facility services folks that and engineers that do a lot of the day-to-day work, and we want to ensure that if there's corrections that are made to our facilities, that they're there for the long haul, and that process stays in place, so that we can ensure that they're accessible for all of our members. Another program that we have in place is our accessible medical equipment. And with the accessible medical equipment, we're providing medical equipment and assistive devices to improve technology for the medical services that we're providing all of our members. One of the things we were able to do is work with some of our vendors that actually manufacture some of the equipment. One of the things that we're really proud of is we had, focus on our wheelchair users, we were able to develop a scale with a company called Scaletronics. We also focus on an exam table that we felt would be more accessible for a number of members, either with limited mobility, and we developed that with a high-low exam table with folks, so it actually lowers. And we're finding that a high-low table assists with a lot of people, not just those members with limited mobility. So we don't have to, and it sounds like you have some benefit from that, so we really appreciate that. Is from a safety perspective, since that's my role now, having people particularly who are low vision or blind try to step up on stools and various things in order to access tables is a real concern of ours. So we're very happy with that table and the access that is provided for, again, not only members with limited mobilities, but a number of other members in the community as well. Another area that we focused on is our communication access solutions. And our communication access solutions is where we want to focus on equal access to health and medical information for our members with disabilities. Under that program, we had a number of things that we had to learn about providing that material, and with that, we took a couple of approaches. One, we were looking at our health education areas and just the general information that's available to all of our members, and wanted to see what we could do to make that more accessible, particularly for our members who are blind or low vision. So what we've done in our health education departments, we've actually installed computers that are public computers that can be accessed by our members. And those computers do have scan and read documents software, so they have the capability to scan documents and put them in audio format. There are some screen readers on those as well. Obviously, we're doing what we can to make sure that a lot of our literature is more accessible to screen reading technology. And we also have software that allow you to enlarge the text and that when you're reading that. So if you're looking to research some information, those are again available in the health education departments at our medical centers. Additionally, if you are contacting member services or your physician and you say you'd like to be provided with some material, we are offering that in alternative formats. Okay. large print is available, and we're working on a number of ways to improve how we are providing a lot of our electronic documents. We can convert documents to audio files, and they're provided on CDs in different various versions. And we've had some requests and actually have provided some materials in Braille. It is available upon request. And we're working through the processes to improve that area. That's one that's relatively new to us, but we do have members that have been provided that. And for materials such as our guidebooks or evidence coverage, things of that nature. Also available in assistive technology or communication access solutions, for our members who are hard of hearing, we do have technology available on your visits called a Pocket Talker. And that device is an assistive listening device that is available in some. Again, we're trying to make that more readily available in our facility, so it's something is available to you upon request or folks who are hard of hearing. Okay.
Good.
Another area that focuses, I mentioned policies and procedures, and these are all internal policies and procedures to help us be more effective in providing the services that we do. And so keep us compliant, obviously, with our laws and regulations providing those services. So I want you to be aware that there's a lot of training and development that's involved in those policies, ensure that our physicians and our staff and other care providers are well aware of what's in place to provide equal access to all our members. Training and education can focus on things for our physicians. We have what we call handbooks for culturally competent care, and they actually address working with members who are low vision and blind, working with members who are hard of hearing or deaf. There's working with children. There's a number of working with people with limited mobility. There's a number of different ones that are available to our physicians and to our staff to bring them up to speed to how they can improve and provide better services for our members with disabilities. We also have little reminder pocket cards for them to kind of help them with some shortcuts to making sure they're providing that care in a competent way. Managers are receiving training so they can make sure that their staff's informed. We're working very diligently to make sure that people are more aware of our ability to convert material to alternative formats. We have some CD tools, brochures, fact sheets, various things that we're distributing throughout the organization to improve the awareness of our staff when it comes to providing access for all our members, including our members with disabilities. In those resources, one of the things that it sounds like you're familiar with is the pharmacy and some of the tools that may be providing, like maybe a talking prescription bottle. So at this time, I'd like to pass the microphone over to Scott Goodrich, and he'll share with you a little bit about our pharmacy services and what's available there.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for having us here this afternoon. The entire focus of the pharmacy, obviously, is to provide the right medication to the right person in the right dose at the right time. So we are very committed for all of our members to receive equal treatment, just as Anthony emphasized equal access. Getting to your provider and getting to your pharmacy does not mean very much if you cannot get equal treatment at the end of the visit. So what we focus on is communication specifically and making sure that that communication is effective and understandable. And that begins with training. Every pharmacy employee is required to complete an online training program. We have our own Department of Training and Education, and they worked with the Center for Disability Issues in the Health Professions at the Western University of Health Sciences in Pomona, California. And in conjunction with the university and local community advocates, they developed a program, again, that all pharmacy employees are required to take. This program emphasizes the available alternative communication formats for both prescription labels and for patient information leaflets that accompany the prescription. It trains our clerks, our technicians, our pharmacists on being able to better identify members who may benefit from the use of alternative communication formats. It helps these employees in perfecting their communication techniques to use with members that may require these alternative communication formats. It gives them, of course, the available vendor resources that we may not have immediately available locally, but are available through our vendors. And I saw, actually, one of the vendors here today in your display area. This is done California-wide for all employees, as I said. And locally, where I work in Santa Rosa, California, we also have individually prepared podcasts on our intranet that teach our employees, not only pharmacy employees, but all employees of the medical center have access to that training. Now, to speak specifically to some of the formats that are available both in prescription labels and in information leaflets, I thought I would at least briefly mention something that is now a requirement in California. Your California State Board of Pharmacy did enact legislation that became effective January 1st of this year in what they call a patient-centered prescription label. And what this legislation does is it requires at least all of the information to be concentrated in 50% of the label area, so it's easy to read and easy to access for individuals. It does require that the typeface be a minimum of 10-point, and they even prescribe it as sans serif typeface, but they do require that it become at least 12-point font upon request. So that is legislated now in California. It should be bigger, I agree. Kaiser obviously complies with the California law. We're pharmacists and we own licensed pharmacies. We do have the ability, though, through our information system, to put the prescription labels in an 18 font on the prescription, and to issue you our information leaflets, the paper that accompanies that, that describes the additional side effects and things, that will come out into at least a 16 font. And as Anthony mentioned, these documents can be converted into audio formats through our health education department. They can also be converted into Braille through an outside vendor, and we have that accessibility. For the box themselves, we do offer something that is called Talking RX.
Yes.
This is a portable, reusable device. It's a digital voice recorder that attaches to most common prescription vials. There is one large and one small. It will take 60 seconds of recorded information, so it's not an entire patient information leaflet. It cannot give you everything that you need to know about that medication, but it can tell you what the medication is, its prescription number, when to take the medication, some of the very common side effects. And again, as I said, this can fit virtually any prescription bottle. There's a little recording button that the pharmacist puts the instructions in, and then you press this bottle into the stand. And with your indulgence, I'll play back one of those for you if you'd like. Tell me if you can hear this okay. Oh, I forgot to mention, to activate it, there's a raised button on the side. It's a smooth finish stand that the prescription sits in, and then you just find the raised button and press.
Prednisone 20 milligram tablets, prescription number 583-173-6988. Dr. Lynn Mortensen, Kaiser Santa Rosa 1 East Pharmacy, telephone number 707-393-4440. Prednisone 20 milligram tablets is an anti-inflammatory medication. You are to take 3 tablets orally each day for 3 days. Begin today. Then take 2 tablets daily for 3 days. Then take 1 tablet daily for 2 days. Then take 1/2 tablet daily for 2 days. Take prednisone with food. Use with your blood sugars if you're a diabetic, as it can affect your blood sugars. Prednisone 20 milligrams is a round, flat, uncoated tablet with a score line for easier division. Thank you for using Kaiser One East Pharmacy.
So again, it does not give the entire consultation that you would receive from a pharmacist when you're face-to-face or over the telephone, but it does provide enough elements of identification that you know what the medication is and can call for refills, etc. We also offer talking glucometers. These are available by prescription, so that would also depend on your coverages, so I can't speak to each and every plan out there, but talking glucometers are available by prescription. And as Anthony said, we do have assistive listening devices called the Pocket Talkers for our members that are hard of hearing. And we also have access to a vendor for interpretive services. It's called Network Interpreting Services. It's available to our pharmacies 24/7. All we need to do is call that 800 number. We can log on. And then for members that are hard of hearing, it can give captioning or it can get actual signing with an interpreter. So those are a few of the things that we offer to assist you in understanding your prescriptions. For other special populations, we do have access also to pictograms that have been standardized and defined by the United States Pharmacopeia. These are very clear pictures. Take a tablet with each meal, so you would see a person putting a tablet into their mouth with a little meal plate in front of them. Those 3 pictures on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. So for people that have cognitive disabilities, perhaps, that's certainly an easier mechanism to understand. So that concludes what I have to say about what we can offer. And I will pass it along to Angel. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
My name is Angel Torrance, and I work with our member services department. And Anthony and Scott did a great job of sharing some of the access information to access to our facilities, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we do. This is my first visit, so I appreciate you having me. Member services. On a day-to-day basis, we provide general information and assistance to members and their families. And we're really unique that not only do we have our member services call centers, but we also have at most of our medical facilities and medical office buildings, we have walk-in services so that members can come in and speak to us directly, and we're able to offer assistance right there at the medical centers. So for member services, we provide lots of education about the services that Kaiser provides. We also provide interpretation of member health plan benefits, and as you know, there are many, many unique benefits that Kaiser offers. In member services, we also are that liaison, and if there is a concern or if there's a situation that we need to assist our members with, we also handle our complaints and grievance process, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. Again, as I mentioned, we have our walk-in offices, which you can actually go in and speak with a member, and those services are provided from 8:30 to 5, Monday through Friday. We are open at lunch hour, so we stay open from the entire 8:30 to 5 o'clock for our members. And that's, then we also have our Stockton Call Center, and that's the place where you can actually call in. At the Stockton Call Center, it's a little bit different that most of our eligibility and benefit and coverage co-payments, and if you have any questions about your benefits, your medical bills, payments, you want to order an ID card, that's where they handle most of those services at our call center. We have our 800 number, it's located on the back of the Kaiser card. It's our 800-464-4000 number that's on the back of your Kaiser card, as well as we have services for our hard of hearing and our typed services, our TTY, and it's our 800 number, 777-1370. And that is a little bit different. They open from that service is available from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. weekdays and 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. on weekends. And as I said earlier, we are that liaison between the member and the organization, and we certainly like to make sure that we are ensuring that our members are have full access to the services we provide. And so we do handle our complaint and grievance process where, and it takes a very formal path when it's received at member services. So that formal path would be the intake process, and that's where our members would speak to us about any concerns that they have, and that we would able to acknowledge those concerns and see how we can assist. And that's really what we do. We try to make sure that our members are gaining full access and getting all their our concerns taken care of, and that's what we'll do there. That formal process then takes another step into the managerial and physician review, and that's where we're doing our thorough investigation, making sure that we are addressing those concerns, each and every concern that a member may have. We're doing the investigation, and then we're responding and hoping that we can get a satisfactory resolution to the concerns that are brought before us. And so we also, in member services, in addition to some of the software that Anthony and Scott shared with you, we also have the ability, we have a lot of materials in terms of evidence of coverage, and that tells you about your benefits. And so we have a lot of ways to make sure that we have alternative formats so that our members are able to have access to that, including the Braille. And in terms of getting that information, it is located at our member services call center, which you would call, and all of our guidebooks and any materials that we offer will be offered in Braille at requested. We also offer our audio files that can be converted, and we also have our large print. And most of our print starts out of a 12 font, but we can take that up into a 18.5. not for most of our materials. And so, again, member services is sort of that liaison. So with all the services that we offer at Kaiser, member services does work very closely with Anthony and his team, as well as Scott and his team, to ensure that members are getting the best possible care and quality of service that we have.
And I see a question. I see two questions. More questions.
Okay, I have a lot of questions. My name is Beth Berenson. I do information referral at Lighthouse for the Blind. And this is one of the questions I get very often. I know that you have the Talking Rx, but not everyone at Kaiser knows they have them. And the only way I have been able to get them in my consumers' hands is literally to either talk to Natasha, who has come and spoken, I'm pretty sure it was Natasha, who has spoken with us before, and I think, Scott, I've spoken with you also about getting these in people's hands, and calling customer service, literally, I think it goes back to Natasha, and then she goes and corrects the problem. Mm. What can we do to get this word out to more people? And then I want to talk about the glucometer as well.
Well, the Talking Rx bottle attachment is available both locally, when prescriptions are filled and sold locally, and available for those that are mailed to you, should you participate in the mail order benefit. Our computer system is flagged to indicate both the need for large font and for the Talking Rx. There is a separate data entry field for that. So if any member is in need of those, they should communicate that during their visit. That can be noted to their profile, so that will become a permanent part of it.
And I'd like to echo on Scott's comment, particularly about the profile. We are taking steps to make it a little easier for staff to recognize those fields. So we're doing more and more training with our staff to so that they're more aware to look for those fields before they assist a member.
Okay, my next question is about what I talk to lots of people on a regular basis who have diabetes and have either low vision or no vision. And one of the challenges is how do they take their blood sugar levels? And either they don't know that Kaiser has these, or they're very out-of-date models. What models are you using currently?
I can't tell you. I'm sorry. I can't get back to you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I have business cards. Have no fear. No. Thank you.
I know there are several models out there. If you perform an internet search, you will find countless varieties. I do not know specifically which one that we do handle. I'm sorry.
Yes. Good evening. Afternoon. I'm Pamela Hill, and I live in the Southern California area. And I just did a program with Kaiser through their education department, and none of the work was in a format that I could read. And when I questioned this, it took 8 weeks to get it. And to this date, they are still working on it properly. I did get a CD that's not usable with my screen reader almost at all. And I'm wondering, why would it take that long if you guys have all this ready for us to use? And it's available for us. And the other question is, I have probably 15 of your talking pill RXs that the pharmacy won't take back and use again. Yeah. And then when I ask them to put my medication on the talking pill bottle, what I get is, are you sure you're blind? It's all over my chart. So I'd just like to know, what can we do with the southern area to get these problems fixed? Thanks.
We do have ADA coordinators at each one of the medical centers, and we've been working diligently to educate them and provide them with information so that they can disseminate that information to the medical center staff and employees that are providing that service. So it is an ongoing training effort to make sure that those things are available. In terms of the I'm not sure what format you were getting some of the material in, and the CD. We've recently
had to work with our local, with our national IT group to make sure that the computers that we had set up to do the conversions are set up appropriately. So we've gone through a revamp of that. We continue to look and monitor that, so they should be more readily accessible to staff. They are particularly in our health, education, and member services department, and we're working very diligently to make sure staff are aware of that so we can provide that in a more timely manner. And also, some of the material was being outsourced, so I'll make note see what we can do to make sure that can be expedited quickly or quicker when it is outsourced to some of the vendors that we work with.
Okay, this is Suzanne Hood from the Central Valley chapter in Fresno. And don't get me wrong, I love Kaiser. I think Kaiser's unparalleled medically. But as one of the prime people who's paid over $800 a month for the last 15 years for Kaiser services, I get awfully tired at being told I need to take my husband's blood glucose readings for him.
And blood pressure.
And blood pressure and everything. Like, I'm supposed to be there every minute of the day to do such a thing. The biggest problem that we have in the Central Valley is the education of every one of the employees that are at Kaiser. And it's ridiculous, because I'm tired of being asked what my husband needs, if he's taking his medications. I don't even know what the heck he's taking. It's not my body. It's not me. He knows what he's taking. Those people, I'm sure they're making enough money that those doctors and neurology and everything else, they need to know how to talk to their patients. I don't care how much money they make. They need to know how to treat their patients. And obviously, they and their nurses that want to give me his card and everything else need to get it together. My husband's gone for at least 8 years without being able to take his blood pressure and his blood glucose readings, because nobody seems to know where or how they would get such a machine when he had one about 12 years ago, but it hasn't worked in a long time. They can't figure out where they would get a machine, who would recommend it. We are getting the talking medication, but I don't know. You guys paint a rosy picture. If I didn't know any better, you had an actor reading that stuff, because we've never gotten anything more than a rushed kind of a what it was, and that's the end of it. But please get some education for the employees and the physicians in the Fresno area especially.
Okay. Yeah, we're making an effort, a much stronger effort, especially now that we've worked through a lot of barriers and have some solutions in place to ensure that the staff and physicians and our other care providers are more aware of the services that are available. So I appreciate you sharing that, and I'll note that about the Central Valley and take that back. I didn't know if there was anything about coverage or
well, in terms of the
complaint process.
Well, the complaint process. Well, you know, as I said before, member services is the advocate for the member, and unfortunately, we're kind of on the back end, but we certainly want to make sure that we are educating ours.
Okay,
this is Ed Crespin. I have quite a few questions, but or concerns.
One.
But we have limited one, okay. Well, me too. Okay, Christy does have a bottle that she wants to share with. Secondly, they did want us, they asked me to read the material on the little device, and I said, I can't. I'm legally blind. Reading the small print onto that, that's really difficult to do. And we basically had an argument with a pharmacist. They did make us pay for the item, and then later on they called us up and said they made an error, which really is frustrating. Then my wife went to get an exam. Now, this is really frustrating. The nurse refused to assist her because she was blind. And she said, I can't do this. You have to have an assistant with you, or the doctor has to be with me because I feel that I'm liable in something with liability. The doctor and her had a discussion, and finally the doctor actually sat with Christy and the nurse, a different nurse, to do the exam, which is really frustrating. The last thing that I want to ask is that I'm a vocational rehabilitation counselor, and I get reports from Kaiser, and it's quite interesting on some of the diagnoses. It says the person is blind, and it talks about other things. But it really should say blind according to what diagnosis. It could be blind in many areas, and that really helps in our documentation, too.
Hi, this is Don Wilcox. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm a Kaiser client. And I thank you very much for the success we're having in Mountain View, in Palo Alto anyway. I love your talking pill bottles. I'd love to recycle them somehow. And I know there is a problem in consistency in ordering talking pill bottles, especially if you're doing it for the mail order. You have to be told which button to push to get a live person. And I'd love to be able to do it online, to put that I want that online. And but thank you very much. It's working there. And what we did with our chapter in Mountain View, we took our chapter many years ago to the Mountain View Center and had an outreach, an in-service for the doctors. And I think it made a little bit of effect.
Well, thank you for that. We appreciate that.
I've been a Kaiser member for a long time, and I'm very happy with Kaiser services. One thing I want to congratulate you on is the transit service at Oakland. I take BART to the MacArthur station, get off. There's very rarely a long wait. I get the shuttle to the Kaiser. I'm there. I go home. It's quick. And if I'm sick and not feeling well, it works really well. And I just want to congratulate you on that service and encourage you to do that at other facilities. I have had some problems with the pharmacies in Oakland and other facilities too, in that I will go up and submit my prescription, and I'll say that I don't see well. Can you let me know when my name posts on the light board?
Okay.
And sometimes people are very friendly, and they'll say, "Sure, we'll let you know." The service really varies, and so I just want to let you know that that's something that needs to be improved. But
okay.
Overall, I'm a very happy Kaiser member.
Well, thank you for that, and that is a concern that is noted, and we're working very diligently again to improve that aspect in our pharmacy. So thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I have a concern, and I've heard you say that you have the talking bottles, that you have the large print bottles, but you don't provide it in Braille, which would leave out a significant population of deafblind people. So what is your resolve for addressing the needs of accessible prescriptions for deafblind?
Well,
we do. Hi, this is Scott. We do have the capability through Braille Plus Incorporated, is the company, to convert either labels or the patient information leaflet itself, that material that accompanies it, that it describes the medication in more detail. We do have that available to us. They tell us that most of their projects ship out within 24 to 48 hours after we contact them.
Where are they at?
They are located in Salem, Oregon.
Okay.
I have a web address. Would you like it?
Sure.
It is BraillePlus.net, www.BraillePlus.net.
Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon. This is Donna Pomerantz, and I am sitting down. Margie just said, "Oh, sit down." I have two questions, one from one of our members who emailed me before a convention and said, what can you do to get information to people, letting them know that you have the talking prescription bottles? Is that something that you can do for all of your patients and let them know, send them something about those services? He wanted to know that. And so if you can answer that one first, and then I'll ask mine.
What I'm hearing very clearly from you this afternoon is that we have an opportunity to improve in the education of our frontline staff.
Yes. Very well put, yes.
Well, thank you. So I can tell you what I personally am going to do. My title is called Area Pharmacy Director. I'm sorry I didn't announce that to you at the beginning. And in that capacity, I am responsible for the 5 licensed outpatient pharmacies in my own service area in Santa Rosa. We serve 150,000 members. We're pretty much a smaller service area as compared up here in Sacramento, Roseville, and South Sacramento, for example. But I can tell you what I will be doing. I also have regional responsibilities for all of Northern California, and I sit on what we call our governance team. Myself and 14 others of my same rank and responsibility sit on this team, and I pledge that I will take to them. We obviously have an opportunity to improve that education. These things are accessible. Yes. The glucometers are accessible. The prescription bottles, prescription talkers are accessible. They are reusable. It's very easy to reprogram. I see no need. Perhaps some people, when you say you want them to recycle the bottle, perhaps they're getting the misunderstanding that it's not the bottle per se. We certainly can't do that by law.
Yeah,
but it disconnects very easily and records almost instantaneously. So I got to tell them, I guess.
Yes.
Well, and, work on that.
And I guess what I would say is my question is I use the talking RX bottles, and so does my husband. And I'm very thankful that my husband started using them long before I did, because he was the one that got to train the people to make sure to have them for us at our pharmacy. The issue is a training issue, and I don't know if there is something that you can do to make sure that all your pharmacists, and again, other, you know, frontline staff, but in our case, it's specifically the pharmacists who need to just give them to us. I realize that you have it on the computer, and that's great. But then when I go and I pick up my drops like I did just before convention, and I open my bag and there the talking RX isn't there, then I say, I need my talking prescription bottles, you know, the talking RX. And they say, oh, but these are eye drops. And then I train them and I say, yes, I know. And I've been getting the talking RX bottles for my eye drops all the time. And then they say, okay. And then they go back and they record them. And then I get them. But they just need to give them to us, especially now that you have them in the data, have it in the data field. They need to give them to us across the board, because not everybody would go in there and do what I did. And so we need to have that, make it happen. You have it, let's make it happen. How do we get that frontline staff trained?
And I hope that, I hope it's not true, as one of our members said earlier here today, that one of your employees said, are you sure you're blind? That's totally inappropriate. That's
inappropriate.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Anthony, this is Gene Lozano. I had a question different from the other ones. And when I had spoken to Natasha, she said there would probably be an opportunity for me to see a facility, a model facility that here in the Sacramento area that is what is felt by Kaiser to be the most accessible for the blind and vision impaired. And I was wondering whether that is in under your area. It was at one time under your other hat, and I was just wondering, I know that opportunity would be made available, but how do I go about to go with somebody with Kaiser to take a look at what would be a model facility here in Sacramento?
Well, thanks, Gene. Definitely I need to take that back to Natasha and follow up with her on that request, because I'm not I'm not in this area anymore, but yeah, and I know that we had worked together in the past because I had you down to look at some of the early work that was done in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you went to the trip to Riverside or not as well, but yeah, and that would be very helpful because the information that you shared with us was very helpful in a lot of things that we're doing in the program right now. So I will take that back to Natasha and have her reach out to you and about this request, and if there's anything I can do working here from the Sacramento area to facilitate that, I'll do what I can.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
We are out of time, friends, and we extended the time. So I would like to thank the folks from Kaiser for being here.
We all have
pent up emotions and everything, and I think we did reasonably well at keeping things in hand.
Thank you.
And I want to thank everyone for allowing me to preside today, and I want to hand the mic back to your president.
Okay, everybody. Do we want a door prize? If you leave, you won't get the door prize. May we have a door prize? While we're drawing for the door prize, I need to make an announcement and let you know that there is a wedding that's happening, and that wedding is going to be letting out right now, just as we do. So what I want you to do is please remember to be very patient with our volunteers. Our volunteers are aware of that, and they will assist you. And are we ready for that door prize?
Yeah. Woo. Goodie bag and $20 cash.
We have a goodie bag and $20 cash. And the winner is, let's see, Don Wilcox. Are you still here? All right. Perfect. Thank you very much. We will see you at Adjusting Our Attitudes at 6 and at the banquet. And remember, be good to our volunteers.